Welcome back to the Global Cooking Plus podcast. I'm Panayota Pimenitou. To be up to date with news from the Global Cooking Plus podcast and suggest your topics, subscribe, like, and review the Global Cooking Plus podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Anchor FM, Amazon Music, and four more podcasting platforms. You can contact the Global Cooking Plus through the podcast, Facebook, and Twitter accounts, the podcast website, globalcookingplus.com, and LinkedIn page. Advanced automobility and transportation, as in innovation in travel futures, goes through our current technologies and new technologies in transportation, including the hybrid period between transitioning from the present to the new transportation technologies. Apart from the progress in specific mobility technologies, such as internal combustion engines in some geographies and regions, fuel cells and batteries, we need to be more informed on multimodal traveling and mobility as service in smart cities travel and what they will entail. Also, our perceived experience quality in automobility 5.0 goes through cars design, which will go as deep as quantifying our cognitive processes mapping. In this episode, I'm talking with Professor Anna Stefanopoulou, William Clay Ford Professor of Technology from the Department of Mechanical Engineering at Michigan University, Ann Arbor in the US, Dr. Alexandros Nikitas from the Huddersfield Business School and Director of the Future Mobility Lab at the University of Huddersfield in the UK, and Dr. Kostas Tilidis, CEO and co-founder of Intended Future, an Associate Professor at University West and part-time associate researcher at the Chalmers University of Technology in Sweden. The recent Russian invasion of Ukraine has emphasized more than ever the energy dependence of the European Union on natural gas. Even some before that invasion envisaged electrification through natural gas. Yet, the green energy transition does not dictate phasing out internal combustion engines and fossil fuels. Based on your expertise in modeling, controlling, and optimizing internal combustion engines, batteries, and fuel cells, what is the future of internal combustion engines, especially towards the green energy transition?
Yes, we are in an opportune timing. I think, unfortunately, for what's happening with the war, that is the unfortunate part. But when it comes to energy transition, I think it's a time where both the industry, the regulation or legislators, and the climate scientists, they all agree. We all agree, between politicians, engineers, scientists, and the rest of the world. I think we feel the problems that fossil fuels gave us. And the important part, it is fossil fuels. The important part is greenhouse gases. And we need to be transitioning, and everybody recognizes that. Going from coal to natural gas was a great change, and it's an opportunity that more and more countries did a decade ago. Now with solar being so cost-effective, we have a lot of efforts in that front. Energy storage is going to be extremely important. So our ability to decarbonize depends on our ability to store energy. Unfortunately, fossil fuels, fossil fuels have a fantastic energy density and a rather easy way of distributing them. And that's the part that it's the hardest when it comes to energy and renewable energy. It's not just the temporal mismatch between the use, the demand, and the supply, but it's also the spatial mismatch where the energy is and where it's needed. Like in the United States, if you have seen the map of demand and supply, of course, the costs, East Coast and West Coast, is the mostly highly populated energy demanding, but the actual renewable energy is in the middle plains, and moving that energy from the middle to the cost is hard. Looking into the ability to create and store and distribute energy in a more decentralized way, it's going to be the most important part. And seeing that and how that would evolve will translate also to how fast urban areas can decarbonize and how fast rural areas can decarbonize, which is going to be a big problem. And I think we should be mindful of that so that we don't generate like a social problem at the same time. You know, we have the north that and the urban population that they're very obviously keen in, interested to decarbonize and use clean energy. But we should not post the burden of this clean energy to some areas like the South Hemisphere. At the same time, we should not put an unreasonable burden to rural communities that they might not be able, you know, just because of distances and other things, they might not be able to afford easily this clean energy. So it is also important as governments are pushing for decarbonization to consider facilitating, again, the remote and rural areas for this decarbonization. The rest was to try to help, but, you know, let the markets pretty much and the technology, you know, do it. But I think we could also help a lot the rest of the society to move forward and not feel left over or left behind. So this is the biggest issue that I see as we move forward.
It is indeed, but even if we're going to use hybrid vehicles, for instance, internal combustion engines are going to be part of those systems. Is there any way that the internal combustion engines, do they actually have a future?
Oh, yes. Okay. Technology-wise, once we have hybrids or even plug-in hybrids, we can have plug-in hybrids that they just need, you know, wall plug, right? Like just our European 220, you can still charge a battery that it's, you know, 30 to 40 kilometers. And we know we use these distances are very, you know, it's a very good planning distance for a vehicle like that can be used mostly electric. And then it has an onboard an engine so that it allows for the case that can be used otherwise. So in my opinion, this is the most important technology. Unfortunately, it's also expensive. It has two power plants, and so it is. It's hard to convince industry, as you probably know. In the U.S., a lot of plug-in hybrids have been abandoned. Hybrids still are the focus for a lot of companies, and I think a transition. But then, unfortunately, they think now that the internal combustion engine is done and over, and so they're just. The way we call it in the US is slap together an internal combustion engine and then just hybridize it. It's kind of tricky. The engine has to be cost effective, so they try to push the cost down. So there is some work there to be done to keep the content in the internal combustion engine that makes it cost effective when it's hybrid. And so if you noticed a lot of hybrid vehicles, they don't, you know, they're not fancy turbocharged or any kind of, they actually look like they are down, their content is lower than the most advanced engines. But the truth is that there is a lot of research and development to bring them to that spot. They use Miller cycle and Atkinson cycle. They use variable valve timing technologies that can actually, you know, allow to turn on and turn off rapidly and still be reliable. Because if you are a hybrid, You try to also use the engine as much as possible at the optimum point and minimize the operation at the non-optimum. So again, even if you're hybrid, you still try to do on-off as much as possible. And then again, you use the battery to do all the load leveling. So it needs batteries that are powerful, I guess, I should say, rather than energy dense. So they have more, they have the electrodes that are thin and materials that are more, they give you fast and high current rates rather than long duration. And on the engine side, we basically use engines that are mostly throttled and naturally aspirated, and maybe with some valve timing technology that we need to improve. So you're right. We can still push forward, and the way to improve hybrid vehicles is through improving internal combustion engines, in fact, which is a little bit of oxymoron because everybody is moving towards batteries at the same time. It's an interesting time. Most companies have stopped or have reduced dramatically their expertise in internal combustion engines. And I don't think there's going to be too much work on that front, at least for light-duty vehicles. Maybe for heavy-duty vehicles, of course, for shipping, for tracking. I think there's still a lot of work to be done for, again, hybridization or range extenders. And I think that's the part that also you can call it plug-in hybrid or range extender. So you can still have small batteries that you can use to get inside cities, European cities, and a lot of small perimeters will want fully electrified vehicles. And so we're looking into batteries that they will have a very small range, but then use the engines to basically continue your operation for the longer distances and outside the narrow perimeter of a high-density population.
Multimodal travel applies different modes of transport to produce a consistent and smooth door-to-door travel experience, including the transport to convey goods to their final destination, reducing transit costs and delivery lead times. In that sense, multimodal travel is essential to potentially decarbonize transport and reduce air pollution and congestion in our cities. Why is too much reliance on clean vehicle engineering not enough for multimodal travel?
Mm-hmm. So clean vehicle engineering, cleaner engines are an asset, are something potentially very beneficial. They could reduce fumes, they could reduce emissions, but it's only a very small tool in the wider toolkit of change that we need to embrace. So it is very, very important to understand that the number one priority is to raise awareness about the problems that can be tackled by a more effective, livable, and sustainable transportation system. Raise awareness, educate, inform people appropriately so that they can take the best possible decisions for themselves and the people they love and the society as a whole, and change the travel behavior and making it more sustainable, making sure that they actually help the environment enjoy benefits, help the system be less constrained and less frustrated because of excessive traffic congestion. And it's about understanding the need to act fast, to act effectively in people-centric ways. We have to understand the society and try to change them incrementally through using good examples and actually ways that combine sticks and carrots, yes? So technology is part of the solution, but it's not the whole solution. I believe behavior change, information provision, and education are of equal status. And obviously, because this leads to policy reform, okay, and planning.
what is the difference between excellent perceived quality and optimal perceived quality? And are these two elements only in focus of the industry, also of the customers?
The difference between optimal perceived quality and the difference between, let's say, excellent perceived quality, I would say this is a question of affordances. And if we would say even more simple, this is a question of money and time a specific car manufacturer can put in the specific car. So if you have enough time and if you have enough money, you can make a perfect car. Technically, everybody going to like, or even if we say even more precise, the target group for what this car is intended for will be extremely happy. Unfortunately, this is never the case. None of the even global brands have enough money. But even if they do, they don't have enough time, because the time of when the car is designed until the car is produced is very critical, and it's extremely shrinking right now comparing to what we had 10 years ago. So let's say if 10 years ago, from design until production, it took 5 years for the new car, today it's probably 2 years, maybe with some delays, 3. So it's like the time has shrunk almost twice, but the amount of work also grew up because of complexity of all these new systems and the perception of the customers. So it's a question of the time and money. And for this reason, actually in Chalmers, we have developed this perceived quality framework and perceived quality attributes importance ranking methodology, which able to measure the impact of specific engineering attributes to the perceived quality. Literally, we can tell with this methodology where company has to spend their money and where they have to put an effort if they want to sell this car in America, in United States. And we worked almost for the last 7 years on this methodology. It became quite successful. It was validated in the real settings and the companies like Volvo Cars, like China Eurovehicle Technology, and Geely cars as well. It's ended up that perceived quality framework right now was transformed also into the startup and supported by Chalmers Ventures. So that's why I have so many titles, but it's still the same job in blending academic experience industrial. In there, we have this startup. The difference with whatever existed before is technically how do we blend a customer's opinion, so the customer's data and customer intelligence, how do we blend it with the internal knowledge of a craftsmanship, or it's another word for the perceived quality in the car industry, from the companies within, because every company have their own culture of working with these issues. So it's a quite unique mix, at the same time providing very repeatable results, quite robust results. But one thing I have to add, probably our listeners should know, that perceived quality from the any company perspective, this is the end of the product development process. The beginning starts when we're designing the car. So it's a design, and then it goes to the design quality, and then it ends into the perceived quality, and there customer come and make judgments. So the final, the big equator coming and say, okay, I'm going to buy the car or not. So this is the difference between these two.
To go through the green energy transition and to go through the green transition, even transportation, we need to address a few technological challenges. Those of hybrid vehicles pinned on batteries and engines, as well as fuel cells. Manufacturers of hybrid electric vehicles look for optimization by reducing those vehicles' weight and cost to become market competitive. One solution appears to reduce the weight or the size of the engine and or battery pack while ensuring safe operation and extending battery life. What is the effect of batteries downsizing in hybrid vehicles? Because you've worked on this topic in your research too.
Indeed, we had 5 years ago, we had an ARPA-A project from the Department of Energy. These are projects that are fast and furious, working with industry hand in hand and government. So in this project, we actually looked into how do we downsize batteries and downsize engines. For this case, what you do is you really need a system that can compute really quickly and optimize at various conditions. And I say that in a way that we do a lot of pre-mapping and a lot of optimization of our system. But when you constrain batteries and you make them very small, then you basically want to use them as much as possible, stretch their use, you know, occasionally fast charge them. At the same time, you want to engineer the possibility of them degrading faster. And, you know, we consider batteries aged and degraded when they have lost 20% of their range. And I think that is because in the past, we had like a 100, you know, let's say kilometers range. So losing 20%, that takes you down to 80. And maybe that starts to be, well, you know, bothersome. Well, if you fast charge once in a while, when you have to do that trip, that is much longer than 80 kilometers, it's okay. As long as you, you know, your algorithm can recognize this small degradation and make sure that as it continues operating, you don't do what we call a positive feedback. And if you know your aids, don't stress yourself now too much, right? So as we have a battery that starts degrading, we need our algorithms and controls to derate them in a way that will slow down further degradation. So we actually showed that we can reduce for the same range, we can reduce sometimes batteries by 30%. If we have a really adaptive system that learns in real time the degradation that it caused occasionally and stops or delays additional degradation, if you just have a damn system that thinks the battery is still young. It's like, you know, being an older person, you have to realize your limitations and take it easier. And we don't have algorithms that do that right now nicely. In addition, you can think of something else. You can have batteries that maybe start losing, you know, start approaching their 80% capacity. And you say, well, okay, I can sell it and maybe now use it in a small, low-speed urban applications. It can do deliveries. It can do, if I know how to test the battery that it's aged and be able to assess how long it's going to last in a new application, then can I actually use the battery and repurpose it for a second life? And I think that is also something, unfortunately, that you know, industry is not very interested in pushing forward, obviously, because they are making, you know, it's more profitable to make new, fresh, shiny things. But it is important for our society, if we really want to reserve resources, to really look at second lives and repurposing of batteries, especially because the upstream and downstream carbon footprint of a battery is very large. So I think that, yeah, that the downsizing for me is very important, not as of, you know, how do we convince a customer or, you know, convince people to like not you know, go for 300 miles, which is kind of ridiculous because I don't drive typically 300 miles without stopping and going to the bathroom and taking a break and stretching my legs. So, you know, it's okay to charge after that. I'm not talking about that. I'm not talking about technologically, can we have a battery that is 100 miles? It's much smaller, it's cheaper. Occasionally you will stretch it, you will use it in a fast charging way. Occasionally you will use, you know, discharge it like deep discharge conditions that also affect the degradation. So all these things, if you are allowed to do it occasionally and you have a way that you can predict forward how these occasions hurt your battery and adjust as you go, we can stretch our resources and then eventually use them even for different applications. They do that in fleets. If you have a large fleet of buses, you can have routes that are longer and you can put then the, let's say, younger, newer, fresher batteries, and then you can rotate your buses as they degrade in shorter routes. You can have overhead chargers, and you can do all this fleet optimization and at the same time adaptive allocation of these resources. If you have good algorithms that know what's happening in real time, it's not easy to do all these resource managements with just a human expert. We tend to max out after, you know, one or two or three dimensions of optimization.
Mobility as a service offers a joint digital channel to enable users to plan, book, and pay for multiple types of mobility services and on-demand moving away from personally owned modes of transportation, similarly to the platforms we use for convenient access to TV, movies, and music. In what ways could mobility as a service advance smart cities travel?
Mm-hmm. This is a very, very interesting topic, and some of our listeners, some of our viewers might not understand exactly what mobility as a service is. It's such a powerful, game-changing force of transition, this one. Actually, it's not something really, really new in the sense that you're going to have all these amazing different vehicle technologies. It's about redistributing transportation resources in a more effective way, in a more efficient way. So mobility as a service comes to replace privately owned transportation with personalized mobility packages, giving access to integrated multimodal services on an as-needed basis, available for a single digital interface via subscription or pay-as-you-go options. So it's right now the most hyped intervention of them all. Even they have even more hype than connecting autonomous vehicles for the people working in the transport academia. At the same time, a lot of people actually start questioning how powerful these systems are and how innovative they are, because what they do now is actually create systems that offer multiple tickets and payments for subscribers, help them optimize their transport choices, provide access to real-time journey information, including traffic and weather conditions, and allows them to address disruptions, delays, and cancellation arising from the journey. So some people might say, already we have that in these travel apps that we have in our mobile phones. So mobility as a service potentially is a higher level of this type of function. And we don't have real mobility as a services system around. We have pilot services, we have mass like or little light services around the world, like the system in Vienna, for instance. It could approximate mobility as a service network. But potentially this intervention, this integrated package of multimodal solutions that you access digitally from a single mobile app could dramatically reduce the number of cars off the roads, because they create opportunities for co-functioning and sharing mobility resources. Therefore, we will see huge reductions in travel delays, in air pollution, in noise nuisance, in energy consumption. We're going to have less transport-related social exclusion and less traffic accidents, better health and well-being, accessibility gains, and household expenditure reductions. But at the same time, a lot of researchers, me included, suggest that if mobility as a service is used predominantly as an Uber-style system, so providing car-centric services, even if you don't have to own a car, you can get the car all the time, then if mobility as a service is a system like that, and this is something that Americans would love to see, because I had interactions, and this is what they believe car sharing or ride sharing is mass. If we get to an Uberized mobility as a service system, then actually we won't enjoy any sustainable travel benefits. Quite the opposite. People that actually now use public transportation because they have to use public transportation because they don't have access to their own vehicle, they might be enabled to actually use more car-centric services. And this potentially could create the exact opposite of what I described for the ideal scenario. So we have to find ways to regulate mobility as a service and make incentivize active transport and public transport solutions and incentivize car-centric services, or maybe even use them as neighborhood feeders to more prime mass transit systems and as an emergency kind of solutions. This is the only way that mobility as a service could work actually in the way we want it to work.
This is why I made the analogy between mobility as a service with the current subscriptions. For instance, we have to various platforms to access music or movies or various TV programs. So one might wonder if, and I tried to avoid any present companies' names to make the term mobility as service more understandable. You mentioned Uber. So how are we going to have mobility as a service further away from the Uber model? And if it's going to be, let's say, a paid subscription to have access to future transport without owning a vehicle or an airplane? For instance, are we going to have all these super connectivity transportation companies that are going to tell me, you know what, Yota, if you're going to pay this subscription every year, you're going to use this bus for free and this airplane, or maybe they're going to offer me different packages to say, you know what, by subscribing to our transportation company every year, paying this fee, you're going to have free access to public buses, let's say in Athens, in Thessaloniki, and you can also travel domestically for free. But then for an additional fee, you could also travel to other parts of Europe. How this business plan is going to look like, and it's going to be very interesting to see.
An excellent analogy you made, Yota. When I try to explain this to my students, I kind of use this or the mobile phone kind of contracts and pay-as-you-go subscriptions. So this is the platform that we start with. It's very, very interesting. It's very, very interesting because this is a hyped kind of familiar intervention of technology, but at the same time, it's so untested in so many ways. You know how you can achieve in full integration when you don't have a transport provider for everything. Yeah. So most likely would be city based or region based. So anything beyond that, there'll be you'll have some different kind of choices, but it will operate like that. Personalized mobility packages that you're going to have access to depending on the amount of money that you're going to pay. But if this is about sustainability, then what I'm saying is that we have to reduce the impact and footprint of these ride-hailing companies. Okay? They still need to be part of the system. Otherwise, this mobility as a service incentive will not have any appeal to most users. But at the same time, we need to get our balances right.
Of course, I understand that these transport, these future transport providers, they will switch to more sustainable technologies in their transportation, therefore having less of carbon footprint to the environment. You mentioned the human touch, not just literally, even metaphorically, to describe the creative space for engineers. And this human touch can become a tool to make more informed engineering decisions and incorporate human senses through artificial intelligence, which perceives quantitative data to deliver quality design. We know human senses and touch are cognitive processes. How could cognitive processes mapping be quantified?
Mm-hmm. Very interesting question, because this is what we are working right now. And this is one of the reasons why, first, as academic and together with my colleagues from academia, we have introduced a so-called a data-informed design. And this is quite a different thing from what we have, what we usually hear around, which is data-driven design. And why it's different and why we are promoting this? It's not just for the sake of different wording or naming. The approach of data-informed design is a joint initiative of Chalmers University, University of West, Royal College of Art, Professor Cyril Diels, Hochschule Niederrhein in Germany with Professor Bastian Quattelbaum, and some other researchers. So what is behind it? If any academic ever would step in into the design room, I mean, in the room with car designers, and we'll try to introduce them some type of a magical black box with machine learning or artificial intelligence inside, which will help them to design cars, and will tell this, okay, this is data-driven design, probably they will immediately put him out of this room, because designers naturally against any type of these approaches. It's also lays down in our educational system. When we educate designers, car designers, from the first grade, from the very beginning, we teach them to break rules. We teach them to break any boundaries, to express themselves freely. And of course, if someone comes later and tells, all right, this program will tell you what to do, it's simply contradiction among the behavior. So this is one of the reasons why we introduced the data-informed design, where the data itself and the output of machine learning algorithms should be seen and can be seen just as another tool. So designer has a pen, designer has a clay sometimes to build a clay model, and designer has a data. And this data just inform designer about what possibly the intended customer would think about the design intent. That means the human touch is still there. So it's a designer with his or her years of experience, a gut feeling, any type of a creativity, all what we human have, what differs us from the machines and the robots. So with all this human touch and spark, we can make simply a little bit more informed decisions if we have these data served. The typical example would be what American car drivers value the most in their interior of the cars. So we have this data to clearly explain. Then it comes to the explanation of the things like the last example. In the past, for example, Tesla cars were perceived as extremely advanced in their software, but probably quite poorly executed in terms of mechanical parts. I mean, in terms of how it looks. Right now, with this data that we gather, we know that this is not actually the case. There's something else why people are choosing Tesla, why Tesla Model 3 was the most sold car until, I think, last month worldwide. So these interactions, they're coming only with the data, but the data does not dictate us what to do. So it's the final word is a designer or engineer who should decide what's the best for the customers, just having this complete picture.
On one hand, we have the option of electric vehicles where one charges a battery with electricity that powers the car. On the other hand, we have hydrogen fuel cell cars that utilize hydrogen for electricity production. What could revolutionize fuel cell cars? We talked about the battery cars, the electrically charged batteries. So what could bring in the revolution to the fuel cell cars powered by hydrogen?
Well, the problem, yes, thank you. So the big technology problems in fuel cells is, again, the hydrogen distribution. Actually, hydrogen generation, probably we can... There is one problem in hydrogen generation. So there is hydrogen generation, hydrogen storage, and distribution. If we could do storage, then we need to, ideally, if we can do small amount of storage distributed, then we can do distributed generation of hydrogen and use renewables. And that is the best because you avoid distribution. But it's a problem. The problem is the cost, because small scales, electrolyzers are not that cheap, and having electrolysis and storage in a decentralized way, it is also expensive. And right now we know how to do it in a very centralized way. We actually produce a lot of hydrogen and we distribute hydrogen from a point source to a point source, especially when we know the general need, the thing about the average flow rates that we need to have, because then we can do good sizing. And in Texas or in certain areas that they have a lot of material processing that rely on hydrogen, we know how to do it and we're doing it already. So can we scale that up for transportation? I think we can, but electrification could cover a lot more. Now, if you're in an island or in a cold environment and you don't have, and you really need to have a very large storage for weeks of energy, then it makes sense to consider fuel cells, because then it's larger production and storage. For that, I think the issue, if you go upstream, the biggest issue is also the water availability. Water at the end is going to be a big, the big unknown in the electrolysis and green hydrogen generation. And managing brown water is I think the most important part. So, or some variability in water composition, because if you take brown water and you purify it at some level, and maybe your the concentrations of particles of impurities is varying, then you need to have an electrolyzer that can quickly adjust conditions, so it doesn't degrade and it doesn't have a problem, safety problems. So in the automation side, I think that's the part that that is interesting. It's not only optimizing, the balance of the plant, what we call the balance of plant in the electrolyzer and the fuel cell, to manage variability of the stream, to manage the downstream power demand, but also how do we manage the variability of the fuel content that we will have. And in our case now, fuel content will be the water purity.
Stay tuned for the second part of Advanced Mobility and Transportation on Artificial Intelligence on the 4th of December 2022. We will look into how AI utilizes engineering knowledge, human senses, and product quality to deliver quality in future automobility. Also, to what degree could AI optimize operative instabilities of hydrogen fuel cells when hybridized? Why could artificial intelligence lead to more sustainable transport, such as protecting connected and autonomous vehicles, and the key areas artificial intelligence could further enhance cyber defense? How important cutting-edge technology is in autonomous vehicles compared to the perceived experience quality? What the deceit of connected and autonomous vehicles is? Until next Sunday, with an episode on the arrival of next-generation energy with Dr. Vasilis Grigoriou, CEO and Chairman at Advent Technologies Holdings. Dr. Grigoriou is a scientist and researcher who transitioned into developing hydrogen and other renewable fuel cell technologies advancement and becoming a successful entrepreneur in the sense of what one might call the steps towards future scientific leadership in research.